Good morning. I would like to call the meeting of the House Education Committee to order. It is 8:03 a.m. Wednesday, March 18th, 2026, in the Betty Davis Room, 106 in the Capitol. Members present from my right are Rep. Eisheid, Rep. Underwood, Rep. Schwanke, Rep. Dybert, Rep. Elam, Co-Chair Rep. Himmschut, and myself, Rep. Story. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take the time to silence your cell phones for the meeting. Thank you for that. The documents for today's meeting have been distributed to members and are available on the table outside the door and on basis. I want to thank Cale Brown, the House Education Secretary from Records, and Susan Quigley from the Juno LIO for staffing our meeting today, and our co-chair committee aides, Tammy Smith and Ella Lubin. Today, the House Education Committee will be conducting the hearing on the governor's appointees for the Alaska Board of Education and Early Development. Renominees are Pamela Dupras and Sally Stockhausen. We are going to hear public testimonies on these reappointees following each of their hearings. Additionally, we are going to hear Senate Bill 23, Civics Education, from Senator Stevens and his staff. We will also take invited and public testimony on Civics Education, Senate Bill 23. First up, we will be hearing from Pamela Dupras, a governor's reappointee for the Alaska State Board of Education and Early Development. And I would like to invite her up to the dais. We are happy to have her in the room today. And as she's coming up, I wanted to remind the members that the Board of Education sets policies, regulations, and strategic goals to ensure quality, standards-based instruction for an excellent education for Alaska students. And it's great that we have you today before us. And if you would like to please tell us about yourself and why you would like to be reconsidered for the Alaska State Board of Education and Early Development. Welcome.
Hello. Hi, I'm Pamela Dupras. My native name is Ongsuch, which means berry. And I grew up in Atka, Alaska. I have been an educator in the state for the past 23 years, and I am interested in continuing on the board because we still have a lot of work to do. I have been passionate about education since a very early age. I grew up in a family of educators, and although my grandmother wanted me to be a lawyer, I ended up being an educator like herself.
Choice.
Yes.
I have lawyer jokes.
Sorry. That's okay. Okay. Yes. So thank you again for being here, and I'm going to open it up for questions. Yes, Rep. Elam.
Thank you. Thank you for coming and for serving and taking the questions from us today. And so I guess my question, as a returning veteran of the board, what did you see as your primary mission while you were serving so far, and then who is kind of your primary interactions with?
When I originally joined the board, I didn't realize that I was finishing out somebody else's term, but I think the catalyst for my interest was that the Alaska Reads Act was just passing, and as an educator, you realize how important that skill is. As we move forward, I'm interested in, because that is such strong legislation and it has made a difference in schools. As we move forward, I hope that we continue to support schools with those types of legislation so that we have clear guidelines of what we need to do to educate the students in Alaska. The second part of your question was?
Who do you phone? Thank you. Who did you primarily interface with throughout your duties on the board?
I interface with the families at the Alaska Native Cultural Charter School, and we attract a lot of people who are moving in from rural Alaska. So I have interactions with them. I also have had the privilege of working all over the state. So I began my teaching career in Barrow, now Utqiagvik, and I still interact with people from that community. I interact with people from Kodiak. I've been in Kodiak. I interact with people from the Glen Allen area. So I interact with quite a few people throughout the state.
Who may follow up?
Rep. Elam.
So with the, you know, state school board, how do you see the relationship between board members, deed, districts, and families?
I think the one skill that I bring is that I listen. I really try to listen, not just to what is coming from the state level, but also what the families and all the people in between are saying. I think I'm in a unique position where I am at a school, and at the school I can see what impact legislation has. At the school I can see what impact funding has. At the school I can see what difference we're making for students and their families. So I hope that answers your question.
It does, but I do have one more follow-up.
Follow-up?
From your vantage point, how do we get to a point where we're achieving our goals academically across the state?
That's a big question.
Mr. Pross?
Yes. I wish I had a clear answer for that. I think it takes one student at a time, and we're working towards making sure all of our educators are educated well enough to meet the needs of our students throughout the state. We've recently just settled on some goals, and I'm very hopeful because I think they're realistic goals so that we start seeing movement in our test scores.
If I may have one more follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. Whose responsibility is it to get us across the line for achieving those goals?
Ms. Dupras?
It's everyone's responsibility. It isn't just a single person. It's all of us. It takes every single person to help educate a child.
If everybody's responsible, thank you. If everybody's responsible, who's accountable?
I guess it depends on what the level is. We're all accountable. If we're all responsible, we are all accountable. When I am looking at test scores of students that I'm teaching, I am accountable for the movement that they're making. A principal is responsible if her teachers aren't making that. So everybody has some level of accountability in the system.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Dupras, it's great to identify yourself for the record when you answer question.
Sorry.
It's just nice for the recorders to know. Thank you. And I see Ms. Rep. Dybert has a question.
Thank you, through the co-chair. It's an honor to be called Ms. Dybert. I third grade teacher for 22 and a half years, and I just want to say thank you for your service in the classroom and servicing our students all these years. My question is, what is your, right now we're grappling with class size here in the legislature. What is like your vision for class size? What's the perfect class size? I'm a public school teacher, and third grade, you know, I had years where we had 27, 28 kids. For me, that was too many. And so I'm just wondering your vision. How do we address some of these class sizes that are, you know, a fifth grade class of 35, I heard the other day, and I think a first grade class, in our testimony was at 30 kids. So thank you so much, Mr. Pross.
This is Mrs. Dupras, and my answer to that is I really think it depends on the management in the class. I have had also had the experience of having 28 kids in a second grade class when I first started teaching in Barrow. And while it was a lot of students, I think it depends on the skill of the teacher in the classroom. We also have a class at our school that is above 30 at sixth grade. And what I notice within that room is the teacher has great management skills, and he does a lot of cooperative learning. So he puts them in groups often. I don't obviously have any control over the class sizes in school buildings, but I do think that once you start to get to those numbers, it is more difficult to build relationships with kids and to make sure you're checking in.
Thank you. Rep. Hemeshute.
Yeah, I have a series of questions, so thank you for being here. Ms. Dupras, through the chair. My first question, I think we talked about this once before, but you have on your resume Spalding. What I didn't realize is 1 year on site. Does that mean you spent a year in Hawaii with Romualda Spalding?
No.
Oh.
No, sorry. Ms. Dupras, through the chair. No, I did not spend, I wish, that would have been nice. I was trained by a trainer when I was teaching in Barrow.
Okay.
Follow up.
I also saw on your resume that you have Linda Mood Bell leadership, apologies, through the chair, and you have letters. Are you able to articulate the difference between Linda Mood Bell and letters?
Through the chair, Mrs. Dupras. The letters is an overarching program and is explaining the theory, and it does have some parts that tell you how to instruct in the classroom, but it's more about like the how-to of reading. I really enjoyed taking letters, but what I found with all the training, my previous training, is that many of those components were inside letters. So letters has provided more of an umbrella of what you need to know as an educator to teach reading, while Linda Mood Bell are specific skills for learning how to read.
So follow up. So letters is an umbrella of all the things you need to know, and one of those things would have been Linda Mood Bell. Kind of like that.
Okay. It's pretty. Sorry, Mrs. Dupras. the like in Linda Mood Bell, depending on which program you're using. Visualizing and verbalizing. They have seeing with stars. They have lips. Mm-hmm. So just depending on what but they are comprehensive. I mean, they're a great way to approach beginning reading, while letters really is talking about all parts of reading, both strands, not just the basic skills that you need in order to learn reading.
Follow up.
So you also have on your resume, thank you for that sort of clarification on Linda Mood Bell, because we had that embedded in my school where I taught, and then the Reads Act came along, and I was like, so what have we changed, or, you know, what's different, because we were already doing some of the stuff. So yeah, it really helps me to understand a little bit better how the two might fit together. you talk about being an English learner. Can you talk more about that?
I certainly can, Mrs. Dupras, through the chair. I grew up in an Unangak-speaking home, which is Aleut. They were very, very pointed about not expecting me to speak. However, I understand the language, and I can read and write the language. As far as speaking goes, I'm pretty elementary, but if I were around it long enough, I would be able to to interact pretty quickly. The one impact that I noticed is as I was transitioning to high school, I went to high school at Mount Edgecombe High School, and then even beyond that to college, that I was missing a lot of vocabulary necessary for school. So I'd spend a lot of time reading over and over and over in order to understand what I was reading. So that's how the language had an impact.
Follow up. Thank you. Through the chair, I just want to take a moment, and maybe I'm going to make a statement without a question, but Alaska has a very high number of ELL, and our ELL kids are generally mostly Indigenous kids. And so being ELL, people always think these are immigrant kids or kids from another place. These are kids whose language is struggling. Mostly, not always. We have some really vibrant language areas in the state. Mm-hmm. But these are kids who may not have home language to go home to, and yet they don't fully have English. Mm-hmm. And this is an area that Alaska could put a lot more effort. So I think I'm just going to make a statement there because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding around ELL in our state. And I wish that our state was more of a leader in exploring Indigenous learners of English. I think there's a lot of room for us to lead in the world in that area. And I haven't seen that leadership, but I also haven't taken a deep dive. It may be happening and I'm unaware. So I do have more questions, though, if I can follow up with some questions.
Follow up. I don't see anyone else in the queue at this point. So okay. Follow up, please.
So as a graduate of Mount Edgecombe, which is located in my hometown of Sitka, through the chair, I want to just ask you how you would characterize the current situation at Mount Edgecombe High School.
Mrs. Duprat, through the chair. We just met last week, and I did not realize the condition that Mount Edgecombe was in. I'd heard some inkling of the decline from families whose students were going to Mount Edgecombe. Currently, just in the difference of seeing those pictures, I think that improvements are being made, and I hope that it'll return to the state that it was in when I was at school there, and it was a school of excellence.
Follow up.
Can you clarify, Ms. Duprat, through the chair, if you're talking about the condition of the physical structure of the buildings or the academic program?
Through the chair, this is Mrs. Duprat. I visited Sitka, this has been several years ago, and I had a friend who I graduated with who was teaching there, and she was very concerned because, and I have no idea who the leadership was at the time because this has been several years ago. She was very concerned because her students were coming to her and they were reading at a fourth and fifth grade level. And she was trying to figure out, while teaching her content, how she was going to address that issue. I can't remember where I was going with the story, but to your question, I think there are academic struggles as well as structural struggles at the school.
Follow up. When was the last board meeting at Mount Edgecombe?
I really don't know. Not since I've been on the board.
Quick follow-up.
How
long have you been on the board? You filled in, and so now you're re-upping. So it's only been a couple of years?
Through the chair, yes.
Okay.
Follow-up.
So what do you think, through the chair, is causing the high rates of attrition at Mount Edgecombe High School this year?
Through the chair, Mrs. Duprat, change. I think change is always difficult. I know they lost a lot of, and they didn't lose, but a lot of teachers who had been there long-term retired. And in education, it's about building relationships. So in order to build that, it happens over time, and you learn over time how that happens. So.
Okay. One more follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. And I'm I can tell you're an excellent educator just because of your, I guess, awareness of that importance of relationship and just how devastating it can be when a teacher that you're counting on is no longer there. So I just wanted to know if you could, what are three actions that you think the State Board of Education could take right now to improve the situation at Mount Edgecombe? As the board for the school, what could you guys do right now?
Through the chair, Mrs. Dupras. We've already taken one. We've called for an ad hoc committee, and I'm hoping through that ad hoc committee that they can identify things that need to happen in order to continue making progress at Mount Edgecombe. So as of this time, I can't name three things, but I am hoping that with the things that are discovered through the ad hoc committee that we can continue moving forward and making progress at Mount Edgecombe.
Follow up.
Okay, so it sounds like you're going to wait for the recommendations of the ad hoc committee to guide what those three or six or ten things might be that you need to do. So a concern I have about the ad hoc committee, and I will confess we have not been able to get back to the five-hour advisory board meeting. It hasn't been posted in a way that we've been able to go back and watch it in my office, so I may be missing some information. And then also from the state board meeting that you recently had, I wasn't able to watch the whole thing yet. So my question is, how will this ad hoc committee be formed? How many people will be on it? What role does the state board have in that? Are you leaving that with the superintendent and with the commissioner to figure out? Are you actively engaged in putting together the ad hoc committee and giving them their charge? So it's you guys are in a tough spot because you are the board for Mount Edgecombe, and yet you're not right there in the community. So it puts a lot of responsibility on you without a lot of the tools that a normal, I don't know if normal is the right word, a typical school board would have. So nevertheless, you're the board for the school, and we're seeing signs that the school is not doing well. So can you talk more about the role of the state board in the formation and the charge and the follow-up of the ad hoc committee?
Through the chair, Mrs. Dupras, it certainly mirrors the challenges that we face in Alaska as far as location and how we're so spread apart. I do not know how the ad hoc committee will be selected. I know there will be I can't remember how many people it is, but like it seemed like it was two kids, two parents, two teachers, and so on. I believe that is being spearheaded by the department. And we actually have one person on our board who is the representative that attends the meetings that you're talking about. moving forward, like I said, I think we're waiting because it does seem to be so controversial, and you're getting people who are saying this and you're getting people who are saying that. I think it's important to remain neutral as a board to really discover what it is that needs to be occurring.
Final comment.
Rep. Hemshoot.
Thank you. Yeah, I just want to recognize what a tough spot you're in because a locally elected school board is on site, and they're able to see, and they're able to talk to people, and they're able to, when something is going wrong in a school or is perceived to be going wrong in a school, you have a local board of people who live in that community who are helping to figure out if there is a problem, what to do about the problem. And you're in the spot of having to do that without being on site, and it puts you in a really tough spot. So I appreciate the work you're doing. And I just wanted to add, I really appreciate your work with English learners of all types. And thank you for being with us today.
Through the chair, Mrs. Dupras, thank you so much. Those are kind words.
Yes, and I have some questions to Mrs. Dupras, and thank you for repeating your name so I'm finally pronouncing it right. I appreciate that. So I was just looking at the makeup of the board, and I see that there is a vacant position in the 2nd Judicial District, which represents Nome, North Slope, and Northwest Arctic. Is that still true?
Through the chair, Mrs. Duprat, yes, that is still true. I think that there is one person that has put in interest, as far as I know. And I have been checking in with the people that I know from those different areas to see if there are other people that might have some interest.
Thank you for that. I really would like to see that role, that position filled as soon as possible. I think that perspective and voice and it helps on the board to have all the seats filled. So what can the... What is the State Board of Education doing to try and get that filled as quickly as possible?
Through the chair, this is Mrs. Duprat. I know that they've sent out messages to the local schools and the superintendents as a call for finding somebody to fill the position.
Thank you for that. It would be nice to have that done before we do appointments so we can confirm that person.
Chair Story, hasn't that position been open for at least a year?
Yes, I don't know. Mrs. Duprat, do you know how long that position's been open?
Through the chair, this is Mrs. Duprat. I'm not sure. My term ended last June, and so I missed a couple of meetings. But I do know that since one of the members that we had previously left, that there has been an empty seat.
Mrs. Duprat, for clarification, no one has applied for that seat?
Through the chair, Mrs. Duprat, as far as I know, there's one person who has applied for the seat.
Thank you for that information. I know it's a governor's his responsibility to appoint someone, so I'm glad that the board is actively working to try and get some appointees. Another question I have is I noticed that any board member can add an agenda item within 15 days request to the board chair and the commissioner to have anything placed on the agenda. Have you had any items that you've requested to be placed on the agenda?
Through the chair, this is Mrs. Duprat. No, I haven't. Through committee meetings, I have really pushed about attendance because that's a major issue in not only my own school but all throughout the state. And so that has become more at the forefront of conversations. But I have not personally requested that an item be added to the agenda.
Thank you for that. Another question I had was in the similar lines of Rep. Hemshoot when she was inquiring about Mount Edgecombe and making sure that community, that school had the support that it needed. And I was confused about why the Advisory Council for Mount Edgecombe, who to me represents people in that community, excuse me, and I think you explained a little bit why you felt needed to have some neutral party, but how does the state board see that advisory committee? Is that something they give attention to? They hear a report from the advisory committee? What does the state board expect of the advisory committee?
Through the chair, Mrs. Duprat, we are hoping for a report that outlines perhaps some of the things that the advisory board, some of the things that they're bringing up in public testimony, like the letters that we received. They were all form letters, and they were asking for two things: the removal of a search for a new superintendent, and the creation of an ad hoc committee. Because I wasn't a part of the advisory team meetings. I do not know why those two, that was their request. So through that, we did move forward with one request, and we're hoping for more answers through a report.
Thank you for that, Mrs. Dupras. Perhaps I didn't explain myself well. I was just wondering, taking a step back from the current situation, the communication, how it has been in the past with this advisory board that to me is in somewhat in place of a local school board, local eyes on the situation who can feed into the state board. This is what's happening. These are the needs. These are challenges. It's what we're doing about it. And just asking if there is not a regular communication with the state board, is that something? I mean, what is that? What is the expectation to hear from that advisory board from the state board?
Through the chair, Mrs. Dupras, the representative or the member on the board who is a part of that committee comes and during our meeting reports on what the advisory committee is discussing in their group.
Thank you. I have another question having to do with communication with local school boards. I know they have their association, the Alaska Associations of School Boards, and I happen to think it is just so important. The state board is hearing from stakeholders, and our local school boards are charged with implementing the board's hopes for academics, for social safety concerns. And how do you make sure the state board is communicating with and hearing from perspectives from the local school board members?
Through the chair, Mrs. Dupras, during our meetings, we have public comment, and we often have board members who are reporting through that public comment, so that's an opportunity that they have. We receive emails from board members, so I think the lines of communication are open, as far as I can tell, for receiving comments or concerns from local school boards.
Thank you for that. Are there any other questions? Yes, I have a question from Rep. Schwanke.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you, Mr. Pro, for being here, being on the hot seat, of course. I'm pretty excited about getting to know you, not having been here when you first entered this opportunity on the board. But given your history, growing up in a very rural community, and Attica is very exciting, and knowing that you've taught elementary education pretty early in your career in some of the rural communities, I focus a lot, not just on this committee, but when I served on the school board in Copper River, on the role of technology in our classrooms. And when we were young, there was no technology. There were no computers in our classrooms. There were no internet connections. There were no smartphones. It was all classical education. And in some cases, in the 80s and 90s, we had some extremely high-performing schools. My question is, what, in your mind, what is the ideal classroom? What does it look like in an elementary school anywhere in Alaska, whether it's the smallest remote community or one of the largest schools in an urban area, as far as combination of utilizing technology versus activities? And then what is the role of the family? Because to me, I feel like Alaska's kind of lost its way in understanding the value of education. And when we're seeing high schoolers come in with a third and fourth grade reading level, I would agree with your assessment that we are all to blame at every level. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on the role of technology specifically on that elementary education level.
Through the chair, Mrs. Dupras, that is a tough question. And actually, I was just having a conversation yesterday at my own school about the impact that technology and social media is having on the culture of our school. I'll speak specifically about my own school. And in the Anchorage School District, there is a no phone policy during the school day in the building. We do use technology as a tool. It is a tool that should be used as far as typing or doing their essays or researching something. But I think this is an issue that I hope everyone is aware of, because it is having great impact on our students and the way that we educate. Insofar as much where, you know, we're reading research about how mothers who breastfeed are on their phones, and so children aren't even getting that opportunity for facial recognition because there's so much time spent on devices. One of the things that we're trying to do at the school that I'm at is provide information through some things that have been published through Screenagers. She's a neuroscientist that has talked about, like, the use of screens and finding that balance.
Quick follow-up?
Follow-up.
I really appreciate that. I know that the pace of education is, or the pace of technology in education is really just rapidly evolving to the point where high school educators are having a hard time with essays from high schoolers, whether to even know that it came from AI versus a high schooler. So things are changing rapidly. And so in my mind, I feel like there's an awful lot of room for competition between types of educational programs. And kind of curious your perspective on the role of competition in education. Is it important to have a variety of different educational opportunities for families to choose from to find the best fit for their child?
Through the chair, Mrs. Dupras, yes, I do think that there needs to be a variety. One thing that I didn't talk about when as part of the question that you asked was, what does the ideal classroom look like? I really do think that if we're following standards, some of that is left to an educator. There are schools that have missions and philosophies, so there are opportunities for families to find the places, especially in the more urban areas. In the rural area, you don't have that choice as much unless you're doing something online. I do think that it's important that our students are interacting. I'd like to see more of that in classrooms with the information that they're learning, because as you mentioned, we're being overloaded with information, but it doesn't mean that we're critically thinking about and using that information.
Yeah. Follow up. One final little question on that front. What's your view of the importance of having recess breaks for younger students and their ability to learn?
Through the chair, Mrs. Dupras, I think it's critical for them to have that break because it's an opportunity where it's less structured for them to learn how to interact with other people.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we have a couple more questions. And I think this, I'm really enjoying the dialogue here right now. This is a time for us to really get to know you. It's important. The State Board of Education is very important in setting policy and directions for academic standards. And I appreciate the questions from committee members. And I'm going to go to Rep. Eichscheid next.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story. Through the Co-Chair, thank you for being here, Mr. Bra. And I, as I noted when I talked to you before the meeting, you taught at Wonder Park Elementary, and that school is three blocks from my home. That's where I vote. So I really appreciate that, and I visit that school this summer, or this fall, I should say, when school was back in session. So, you know, you've been teaching for a while in a variety of places. I taught for 25 years all in the same school, so I didn't have the variety. But one thing I learned is veteran teachers oftentimes have a real clear-eyed view on what will improve education, and not everyone asks them. So I'm going to ask you, what are two things that would move the needle on education? I'm not even saying what that needle is, but what are two things that could happen or we could do in the state of Alaska that would fundamentally improve education in Alaska?
Through the chair, Mrs. Duprat, the first part that I want to mention is that I believe that if we provide high quality training in our state to support teachers so that they are comfortable coming into the classroom, one of the things that I noticed mid-career is that there's a lot of reliance on the manuals that we're provided with in school as far as that being the end all of instruction. They are a guide, but I think that as educators, we need to be well educated about how we teach students, and that requires flexibility and your own ability to keep researching and learning in order to meet the needs of your students. But I do believe that providing high quality training in the state would help that. The second part, I actually have written down like what my own dream school would be, and it is definitely a whole lot more interaction with the families and the students. And currently, I'm at a school that I feel like matches more of that, but I would need more time to develop the idea, but the one definitely is high quality training in the state and a little more autonomy for teachers to realize that they are respected and are the people who are providing the education our students need.
Follow-up comment, briefly.
Follow-up.
On the allowing professional autonomy, I totally agree with that. You're given a curriculum. How you deliver that curriculum is a professional decision oftentimes. And of course, we have supervision, but I really appreciate that, so thank you.
Thank you for that, and I'm going to go to Rep. Dibert for the last question. We have another person that we're hearing from today and a bill hearing, so thank you. And
okay.
Ms. Rep. Dibert.
Thank you, through the co-chair. I'll try to be quick. I think the coffee is kicking in now, and I'm like waking up. thank you for the second bite at the apple. I learned a new word, screenagers. Thank you for that. That's a new one for me. And it's very fitting now with our time, and it's difficult to deal with. But I'm really glad that we passed legislation that kind of addresses it for schools. My question is, I was also going to say we were early on in session, Rep. Schwanke, my colleague here to my right, mentioned recess and how important it is. I too believe getting outdoors, and I was approached by some middle schoolers and high schoolers who also advocated for recess to continue into middle school and high school, and the reasons why. I thought that was just interesting and maybe something to think further down the road on. My question is, in your view, if a district has limited financial resources and all other things being equal, when it comes to schools in a district, would you prioritize the neighborhood school over if a district was going to propose a charter school when push comes to shove? Thank you.
Through the chair, Mrs. Duprat, that's a difficult question because I've spent most of my career in public education, and the charter school that I am at is a public charter. It's open to anybody. I think it's important for parents to be involved, and I know that with all the school closures that are being faced in many districts, we have been hearing about the charter that they want to develop in Fairbanks, and I think that a strong school is one where people are involved. So if we have parents who and people in the community who want to support a school, I am in agreement with that, but not over providing neighborhood schools.
Thank you for your responses to our questions this morning. It was great to have you before us. I am going to open public testimony right now on the reappointment of Pamela Duprat for the appointment to the Alaska State Board of Education and Early Development. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Seeing no one in the room, is there anyone online who would like to testify? No, there is no one online either, so I will close public testimony. Thank you again very much for being with us today.
Through the chair, thank you. It's been a privilege.
So next up, we will be hearing from Sally Stockhausen, who is a reappointee to the governor's is a reappointing of the governor for the Alaska State Board of Education and Early Development. Ms. Stockhausen is online. Welcome, Ms. Stockhausen. Congratulations on being re-nominated for the Alaska State Board. Please unmute yourself, identify yourself for the record. Tell us a little bit more about yourself and why you would like to be reconsidered to serve on the state board.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Sally Stockhausen. I became an educator in 1998 in Fort Worth, Texas. I taught middle school English. My husband and I moved to Alaska in 2002, thinking we would stay here. We were newly married. We were thinking we would stay here for a couple of years for an adventure. And here we are. We're still here. We taught in Copper River School District for 6 years. And then in 2008, we moved down here in Ketchikan. And we've been here ever since. Most of my career, starting in Alaska, so 2002, has been in special education. This is my 3 years ago, I moved over into the administration field, and currently I'm the special education director for Ketchikan Gateway Borough School District. Why I would love to be reappointed on the board is I believe in what we're doing, and I'm very excited when I think about what we've done in the last years. I'm most excited about the reading training that we've put in place for teachers and also the apprenticeship program in terms of just providing pathways for to grow our own for our teachers in Alaska.
Thank you for that introduction. Do I have questions for Ms. Stockhausen from the committee? Rep. Schwanke.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you, Ms. Stockhausen, for being here. It's always good to see you again.
Excuse me for a moment, Ms. Rep. Schwanke. I hear an echo. Oh,
Ms. Stockhausen, if you could take off your speaker on your cell phone or on your computer, I think it's causing an echo here.
She's on Teams, so is that...
Okay, is that better?
Yes, very much. Thank you for doing that.
Okay.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Rep. Schronke. Please continue.
Yeah, you're fine. Thank you, Rep. Story. Ms. Stockhausen, I have a couple questions kind of based on your experience here in the SPED arena. One of the things that we've seen is growing numbers of children in the SPED programs throughout the state over the last decade. And when you pair that with the number of kids in correspondence programs and the requirement of the districts to then provide special education services for our correspondence students, I would like to get your take on how that is affecting the special education programs kind of across the state, and how we can better achieve the services that these families need and deserve from a funding perspective. And just for clarity, I do have a bill out there that would add the 1.2 multiplier to the correspondence student within the formula factor. But I also want to get your take on that funding that comes to districts from that 1.2 multiplier, and what do you see as the split between how districts should be utilizing those funds for special education services versus gifted and talented program opportunities? And is there room for improvement in helping us achieve both?
Mm-hmm. So that is a tricky, tricky situation. So it's a really tough question. And so I'm going to try to answer it. There were several questions in there, Representative Swatchke, so please make sure that you push back on me if I miss some. I think the nature of correspondence schools and being able to provide special education services is very tricky because the parent is the teacher. And so do you support the parent in how to do that? And it's really based on what the student needs. And so sometimes the student can be taught through virtual services like teletherapy, maybe if they have special education needs in speech. And so the parent can't bring the child in to see the speech therapist in the local school district. And so the services we provided by distance. It really is going to be, and I would say this, the answer is the same for gifted and talented. It really has to do with what the child needs and then also what the family is willing to do. It's tricky when the family is the teacher and the family is in the driving seat of that, because if they're willing to do it and if they're willing to accept the support, then great, but sometimes they would rather do it their own way, which they can because they're the parents and they know their children best. It's just a tricky place as sitting in the special education seat. It's really hard to navigate that.
Follow up. I appreciate that, Ms. Stockhausen. I would agree that especially with the correspondence students, it so much does fall on the shoulders of the parents. But my question was more along the way of how are districts able to provide the services necessary when it comes to things like OT and speech therapy. Those are services that are absolutely required of the district to provide, yet the district doesn't receive any additional funding for those programs. And then the GT, my apologies, question was more along the lines of kind of a statewide all-school perspective. I know that it's required that every district is supposed to have a gifted and talented program, but my understanding is that many don't. And in challenging funding situations, many districts drop their gifted and talented programs altogether. And I understand that's a very high bar to actually achieve kind of a gifted and talented level for an individual student. But the background really is that we want to make sure that we're challenging all of our students, and we definitely don't want them to be bored within any certain classroom, right? So if a child is advanced, that we have the opportunity to still challenge them as much as we possibly can to continually keep them engaged and moving forward. So is it enough that we just have a single multiplier, 1.2, in the foundation formula with no other guidance on where those dollars are supposed to be spent, with the challenge of the two needs? We need to address special education services, but we also need to address the potential for gifted and talented. And I'm just kind of curious, from your admin perspective, how is that working, I think, across the state? And should the legislature look at trying to address that in a different way to try to achieve both?
Mrs. Stockhausen, could you please introduce yourself when you speak each time?
Sorry about that.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Through the chair, this is Sally Stockhausen. Representative Schwanke, are you talking about specifically for correspondence, or are you talking about for all schools?
It's for all schools, the 1.2.
Yeah.
Mrs.
Okay.
Stockhausen?
Yes.
I was just acknowledging you to speak.
Okay.
And
sorry.
Introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Through the chair, this is Sally Stockhausen. I think that from an admin perspective, of course, more money is always great. We can do more with more money. But at the same time, where is that money going to come from? And so where we live is we have to provide the services with the money that we're allocated. And so how we do that locally is usually, like, if we have to modify up for gifted and talented, then that really ends up being the teacher's responsibility or the school's responsibility, the principal, to support that. In terms of the services for special education, no matter how much money we have, we still will provide those needs as identified in the IEPs.
Thank you for that. Do I have other questions? I see some from Rep. Eichheit, and members, please try, and we have limited time, so please try and narrow your question and be succinct. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story. So, Ms. Stockhausen, the question through the co-chair I have is, you've been an English teacher till just fairly recently. It says you taught writing, so that means you ask students to write. And as we all know, there is a funding crisis or an issue with budgets at many, many, many school districts. Class sizes are increasing. I represent Anchorage. We're facing big deficits this year and next year. So in the face of increasing class sizes, and using your experience as a English teacher who presumably assigned writing and evaluated it, in the face of increasing class sizes at all grade levels, how do we improve education in that environment, educational outcomes?
Through the chair, this is Sally Stockhausen. Are you talking about specifically in writing or across the board in all outcomes?
Rep. Eichheit.
Through the chair, in all outcomes. I was trying to be brief, okay. But, elementary class sizes where we're teaching reading, increasing all throughout almost all districts. And so in that environment, how do we push the needle forward, or should we expect to keep educational outcomes low, have low expectations because we're creating an environment that makes it hard to provide quality education?
Mm-hmm. Mrs. Stockhausen.
Through the chair, this is Sally Stockhausen. When I left Texas, now again, this is almost 25 years ago, my class sizes were always 34 in every class, and that was sixth grade. But that's what we were all used to, and we were trained to handle that. We were trained. This was where classroom management was very much a priority in training in that. Now, it would be easy for me to sit in my seat and say, oh, I taught 34 kids. This is nothing. You're going to 24. But the reality is that in Alaska, teachers aren't used to class sizes that big. And so what we have to do as schools, as principals, we have to take on that role of supporting teachers who need that to support them and train them on how to manage larger class sizes. We can't just shove more kids in classes and expect teachers to adjust. They aren't used to it, and it's going to be very new for them. And so I think that's one of the first things we can do, and we're going to have to address that as a state, at the building level, at the district level. And then I think we need to maintain our focus and our commitment to providing strong science or reading training based in the science of reading, and we can't let off on that. We have to continue to provide that training so that teachers can come in ready to do that. And I mean, if I had a dream, I would find like a dream school. Teachers need more time. I mean, we keep adding more and more kids and more expectations, and they just need more time. And I don't know how you do that. You can't make that day longer, but could we take some of the things off of their plates so that they can focus on the most critical, most important things? If we want outcomes to change, we're going to have to change what we're expecting teachers to do. They can only do so much in a day. And then I think the last thing that we could do as a state is that would be really helpful is if when students come out of the universities, and I feel like our in-state universities are really making gains in that way of making sure that they also are providing training with programs aligned in the science of reading so that they come out of school, if they're trained locally, that they already know how to teach reading and they're not relying on the district to continue to provide that training. And I think nationwide, we're starting to see that, and we're starting to see universities take that on as well. It's really going to have to be a team approach.
Thank you for that. I have two representatives on my list, Rep. Dybert and then Rep. Himshute.
Good morning, Ms. Stockhausen. Through the co-chair, thank you for being here. And congratulations on being renominated, and for your service to students here in Alaska. My question is, I just seeing your experience in special ed, and I really appreciate it. I think you hit briefly on the topic of growing your own, and I just think about SPED teachers across Alaska. I know there's a shortage. Right now, just the schools that I visited this past fall, where we have VISA teachers coming in, taking on these classes to teach SPED students, and then the paperwork side of it falling on the principals of the schools. And then I spoke to a teacher that had 65 SPED cases on their load at a high school. So retention in SPED is very important, but also just retention with just in our state. And what is your vision to help us, your work? What do you see yourself working on where we could address this major issue? Thank you.
Through the chair, this is Sally Stockhausen. I am very excited about our apprenticeship program, and this is why, because you see these paraprofessionals who sometimes are working in special education and teachers come and go and come and go and come and go, and those paraprofessionals live in the community, and they know the families, they know the students, and they've some of them have been there, so they know generations of students. And so I would love to see what we can do to train them so that they can step into those roles and provide those services. When I first started in Copper River School District, and it was very similar, I was there when we moved there. My husband got a job right away, and they didn't have any teaching positions open for me, and so I was a paraprofessional. And the sped teacher from out of state left right before school started, and so they were like, okay, Sally, you're going to have to provide services. We're going to have a retired special ed teacher come in and do the special education side. And that's where I discovered my passion for special education. And I went back to school and got my degree in special education. But at that time, there was a paraprofessional there. Her name was Peggy Knight. And I learned so much from her. And as people were coming and going, she was there. And she was a paraprofessional. So when I hear and when I talk about teacher apprenticeship, it's Peggy's face that I see. And there are Peggy's all over this state who provide that stability. And I think if we're ever going to move the needle, if we're going to turn the corner, whatever phrase you want to use on teacher retention, it's going to have to be focused on growing our own and providing the support for our paraprofessionals who are there and committed to be able to get their degrees.
Thank you for that. I have Rep. Hemshoot and then Rep. Elam, and then I'm going to close questions.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Stockhausen. Thank you for being here this morning. It's great to see you. I have a ton of questions, and most of them are going to have to do with Mount Edgecombe. So I want to start by asking what you, through the chair, what do you see as the state board's responsibility in overseeing a state-run boarding school?
Through the chair, this is Sally Stockhausen. Thank you for the question. And as you mentioned when you were discussing with Member Duprat, it's tricky. It's a very unique situation because we are so far removed, and we have to rely on the input that we receive. At the same time, most of the advisory board, and I'm the state board representative on the advisory board as well, most of them also aren't local. And so it is a tricky situation, but I think our role is to listen and then to provide guidance as much as we can.
Follow up.
Okay, thank you for that. Yeah, and the advisory board may not be local, but they all either went to Mount Edgecombe or have kids at Mount Edgecombe, or so they're related more to the school than the state board generally is. So I think they have a lot of valuable input. My next question is, how do you as the state board evaluate leadership performance at Mount Edgecombe High School? A local board evaluates the superintendent. Do you have that role as the state board with the leadership of Mount Edgecombe?
Through the chair, this is Sally Stockhausen. I believe that authority, because it's a little bit different, he's a director, or that person in that role is a director, and so I believe that evaluation role lies with the commissioner.
Follow up.
Okay, thank you. So I guess I just want to understand your understanding, position, opinion on the line between the state board's oversight and the department's oversight of Mount Edgecombe High School.
Through the chair, this is Sally Stockhausen. You know, that we are their school board, but it's not as defined as your typical school board. It's, you add in the deed oversight as well. And so we really are a team, and we have to go back and forth. They provide a lot of assistance in terms of budgetary assistance, in terms of management assistance, and then we have to oversee that and provide input as we can hear from them. One thing we talked about in our last board meeting is we used to get in person, not in person with a because we don't meet very often in person, but at least through Zoom, seeing the superintendent there presenting to us. And so we did ask for that to happen at our meetings from now on. We had gotten in the habit probably two superintendents ago. We used to always have the superintendent would come and give a verbal report. And at some point, it kind of just shifted and it became we would get written reports. So we did ask for that to come back. And I was thinking as you were asking Member Duprat questions, I think one thing we could do is also add a component to his report for advisory board comments or advisory board report or report of that meeting. Because I think you might be onto something that there's a little bit of a break there. The advisory board's role is to advise the superintendent, but it would be good, I think, to add a component where that could come back to us. So at least we could know the whole board. We just need some communication improvements.
Follow up.
Yeah, I would support opening those lines of communication wide. Like, I think right now we're kind of in an all hands on deck moment for that school. So my next question is, the state board meets from time to time at Mount Edgecombe High School. When was the last time the state board met on campus at Mount Edgecombe?
When you asked Member Duprat that, I was trying to remember as well. And I think that it was right after COVID when we could travel again. And so I'm going to have to go back and double check it, but I'm guessing it was 2021.
Follow up.
So I'd like to point out the state board used to meet every other year in September at Mount Edgecombe High School, and travel was so extremely limited for the board. I was happy to see the board start meeting in places like Kenai and I think Wasilla and Kotzebue. There have been meetings. You guys are one of two boards that really sort of set the lives for people across the state, the Board of Fish and State Board of Education. And the Board of Fish has a regular cycle where they meet all over the state. And our state board used to do that in the 80s and in the 90s. They met in all kinds of communities. Budgets got tight. It started being more online, fewer in-person meetings. And then those in-person meetings were all in Juneau. So now you guys did start going back out into the state, which I support, but not at the expense of being on campus at Mount Edgecombe High School. So I'm just going to say that on the record right now. I would, I don't know if we get to set an expectation for your board, but as much as we're allowed to do that, I would encourage the board to meet in September as much as possible or at any other point on campus in Sitka. Okay, so I just have one or two more questions. What structural changes would you make, given what we've all been watching at Mount Edgecombe? What are the structural changes that could avoid, whether a person believes that the problems are in communication or the problems are in the facilities or the problems are in the changes that have happened, how can we avoid this school falling into a crisis in the future? Are there structural changes that we could make?
Through the chair, this is Sally Stockhausen. Before I answer that question, I also want to respond to your comment about travel. We would love to be able to do that. I think one of the most powerful meetings that I've had since I've been on the board is when we went out to Kotzebue, and it just was very eye-opening to me. And when I would love to see that we could go out to those communities when school is in session so that we could visit with teachers, we could visit with families, we could see kids, we could see the condition of the facilities with kids in there. And I believe that the whole board would be supportive of that. We just need to be able to do that in our budget. So absolutely, we totally agree with you. I just think it would be critical. In terms of structurally, I think the communication, and I agree, having us on site would be helpful at Mount Edgecombe. If we could go there at least once a year, have a meeting there at least once a year to see it, I think that would help. It would help to establish relationships. And I think it really will help having the Mount Edgecombe director come and present to us so that we can ask questions. I think he has inherited some things that he has really been able to go in and change and repair. And I think, to be fair, we need to give him time to continue to do that. And I'm looking forward to see what the ad hoc committee comes back and their recommendations, so that we can address. And I think when we get those back, I think what will be important is we set them as goals. We take those recommendations and set them as goals so that there can be some accountability, very clear, like who's responsible, what the measuring stick's going to be, so that we can see where we are in however much time we set for those SMART goals.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Final comment?
Final comment.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Stockhausen, for being here and for thinking deeply about what we can do next for Mount Edgecombe High School and for all of our schools. And I just want to thank you also for the blue and gold ribbon work that the State Board is doing. And I'm eager to see the next steps on Alaska's Education Challenge. So I think you guys have a lot on your plates, and I recognize the challenges of meeting as infrequently as you do and as infrequently in person as you do. So thank you for being here today.
We have our last.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I want to also add my thank yous, too, and I want to note that President Stevens is in the room for we're going to be going next to his bill hearing. But first, I want to open public testimony on the appointment of Sally Stockhausen to the Alaska State Board of Education and Early Development. Public testimony is open. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Seeing none. Is there anyone online who wishes to testify? Seeing none. Public testimony is closed, and we are now back in the room. We will next move to signing the hearing report on the governor's appointees to the Alaska State Board of Education and Early Development. In accordance with Alaska Statute 39.05.080, the Education Committee held a hearing on the following appointees, Pamela Duprat and Sally Stockhausen, for the Alaska State Board of Education and Early Development. A signature on this report does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmations of the individuals during any further sessions. I will take a brief at ease while Senator Stevens comes forward, and we will sign the report.
We are now back on record at the House Education Committee room, and we are going to hear Senate Bill 23 on civics education from Senator Stevens and his staff, Tim Lampkin. Welcome, President Stevens and Mr. Lampkin. We're glad to have you in the Education Committee room today. Please introduce yourself for the record. Begin your presentation.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for hearing us on this bill. Senator Gary Stevens, Kodiak. So Senate Bill 23 on civics education is one of a lot of things we should be doing in our education system to restore an understanding and really a faith in our government among those people who are in our younger generations. This bill calls for an establishment of a civics program graduation requirement. Where students must either complete either a semester course, many schools do that, many districts do that, or pass a civics test or complete a civics project, like being involved in a campaign or doing something locally in their school. Lots of ways, those are three ways to do that in order to graduate from high school. It tasks our State Board of Education Early Development to provide a clear list of curriculum resources to help our school districts. And what we hope to do is to rekindle a spirit within our education system to help foster citizenship and voting and community engagement, which is really a fundamental purpose, I think, of public education. It's also a purpose that's quite consistent with our founding fathers' vision of an education system intended to create good citizens. And I'll just close with a couple of comments from George Washington, which really impressed, I got to say, impressed my Senate Finance Committee to hear from Washington. But what Washington said is that he viewed education as a critical for a thriving republic. He said a primary object should be on the education of our youth in what he called the science of government with specific knowledge. And I said, what species of knowledge can be equally important? That's really an issue that I think is of great significance. What is more important than educating our children in the form of government that we have? Because education serves to educate citizens on what he called the just way of thinking. So thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you hearing this. We're glad to answer any questions or provide any further information. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Would you prefer to have questions now or have your invited testimony and then questions?
Let's go ahead with the testimony if you would like.
Okay, I will do that. First of all, I have Alex Copeland on the line. He is a member of Kenai Peninsula Votes. I don't know if he's on Teams or on the phone.
Yeah, hi, this is Alex Copeland.
Welcome, Mr. Copeland. Yeah, please introduce yourself for the record and any affiliation.
Sure. I'm Alex Copeland, and I'm in Homer here to testify in support of Senate Bill 23 for myself. I belong to a bunch of other organizations, but I'm sort of need to talk to them, so I'm just doing it for me. And I know I have 3 minutes or so, but I did listen to the previous conversation, and I thought it was outstanding, and it sort of deals a little bit with Senate Bill 23, as we know that, you know, public education, we're keep asking to do more, and you know, it's like we realize everybody in this committee room understands the problem, is well aware of it, so I'm sort of preaching to the choir. My experience, though, so for SB 23, I've been talking to Senator Stevens and their staff about this bill, and we had some strong objections, and when I say we, other organizations I work with, and it's necessary that we have a civics education. It's necessary that we do it K through 12. You know, if we're asking the high school to do it now, and most schools out of the 55 districts, I believe that many of them are doing that, minus the civics test that Senator Stevens is requiring or asking on this bill, I should say. And this is where I had a question when I was listening to Senator Stevens right now. Is it passing the civics test at 70% and or a project-based assessment? I wasn't sure, so that was a question. But I still support the bill. The concerns I have right now about the bill is I don't think I've been a special education teacher forever in Alaska. I've taught over 40 years between Washington and Alaska, and I've taught in the bush, I've taught in Homer, I've taught all over. I think the special education waiver needs to be really looked into, because many special education students are very capable of passing any test with giving the accommodations and modifications. And that should be considered a little bit more strongly in the wording of the bill, because it seems like there's a waiver of availability. And I think we just should make sure that that's not overused, because I think any special education student, regardless, can pass it, especially if we add some modifications to the testing based on their cognitive ability. So those things should be just brought in, I think, just a little bit more. I do applaud the project-based assessment. I think whenever you do things and you make it real life, it's just a huge learning instrument. As we all know, we did algebra and calculus and math as we did high school, but if we don't use it, we lose it. I'd love for the legislative branch to have a, I know you guys are busy, and I applaud all the work you all do, and I know we don't always agree, but the work you do is substantial. But having a night of civics education once a month so people can call in and say, you know, rudimentary questions like, how do you testify? How does the bill work? Does it? A lot of people don't understand the intricacies of going to both houses to be passed. I mean, there's a lot of complications here. And with Senator Stevens' bills in high school, a lot of that is covered. But as I've talked to their office before on the 55 school districts, many of them are doing that now, I believe. I know the Kenai does, because I taught U.S. government here. I was did it through the praxis system as a special ed teacher, and then I got my history in government endorsement. And Alaska studies, too. I think we do a great job. I know on the Kenai we do, of teaching this. But do students retain it? You know, does a test tell me what a great citizen you're going to be? No, but community effort does, and we're all involved. That's what I heard in the conversation previous. You know, are we pointing the finger? You know, we can point all day long, but we're all accountable for developing a system of Alaskans that are just phenomenal. And just, you know, I love the community here, and a lot of them went to the schools here, and they just did super. But again, I support his bill. I am concerned that if we keep asking more of educators or school districts, it's like, okay, well, how are we going to do that? I see that there's a fiscal note. The note has been changed a little bit. I believe the curriculum's out there where the State Board of Education doesn't need to create it, and I saw that they can use resources available to them instead of creating those new curriculum, because we have it. It's all there. And anyways, I think that is all I did. I just got back from a trip, so I just got in last night. So I appreciate the time and what you guys are doing. And, yeah, civics education, yeah, if you understand the executive Unitarian theory, then you're in Article 2. That's, you know, there's a lot to be covered. But the more we can talk about it, the more we can discuss it, the better we're going to be as a country. So thank you, Senator Stevens, for putting this bill on, for making this a priority, and for the committee today to listen to me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Copeland. Are there any questions? Seeing none, we are going to go next to – thank you for your testimony. Seeing no questions, we're going to go on to Dr. Sean Healy, Chief Policy and Advocacy Advisor with iCivics.org. Please, I want to say welcome, Dr. Healy, and unmute yourself for the record, and please identify yourself and begin your testimony.
Yeah, good morning. My name is Sean Healy. I am the Chief Policy and Advocacy Officer for iCivics, and here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 23. I work for iCivics, which is retired or former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's legacy organization. And she often said that civic knowledge is not passed through the gene pool, has to be developed with each successive generation. And a comprehensive civic education is so critical to that end. It's vital for developing the civic knowledge, skills, attitudes, and behaviors that are necessary for informed, effective engagement throughout one's life. And it goes without saying, I think it's even more important as we round the turn towards celebrating our 250th birthday mm-hmm. this coming July. I see this bill very much as a legacy, and a generational investment in our rising citizens. We lead a national coalition called Civics Now. It has over 415 members. We're active in just about every state in the country. iCivics offers free curriculum, so I hope that would support this course, and it's utilized in all 50 states, including Alaska. Each year, we do a scan of state policy, and we put forth some recommendations of what states should do with respect to civic education. And one, we think it's really important that there's dedicated instructional time for civics. We recommend a high school course, a middle school course, and designated instructional time in K-5. And just to give you an anecdote about why that's important, we have, of course, a national assessment of educational progress in civics. The last couple of cycles, we've only administered it with eighth graders. But we found in the last assessment, the 2022 assessment, our analysis, that young people that had a class in civics in eighth grade did about 10% better on this test that measured their civic knowledge or skills. So teaching civics overtly matters, has to be reflected in state standards. It's critical that civics be assessed. We're in this environment, right, of course, where if it's not taught, if it's not tested, it's not taught. And how we assess it can vary. So we very much support a project-based approach to assessment. It's also important that we recognize students in schools for excellence in schools. And I salute the civic seals part of this bill. 12 states are already doing that, recognizing students on their graduation diplomas for excellence in civics. And to the testimony of the previous constituent, it's really important that we invest in our teachers, that we provide them with ongoing professional learning opportunities to develop both their civic knowledge and their pedagogies for implementing that in the classroom. We did a scan of state policies last year in 2025. We found that 37 states require a standalone high school course in civics. Seven of those states do it for a full year. Of course, this bill would make Alaska the 38th state. Only five states have a standalone middle school class, but 47 states do require instruction in civics in the middle grades. That includes Alaska, and that's per state standards. 29 states have some type of assessment. A little over half of them use some version of the U.S. naturalization test. Massachusetts is a state that does use a project-based assessment, as does Tennessee. So there's a couple other models for that out there. I recognize that 12 states have civic seals. Six other states recognize schools for excellence in civics, and one state, Delaware, recognizes teachers. And then finally, 44 states, including Alaska, provide professional learning opportunities for teachers in civics. So I'll close by saying that we're not sentenced to this current predicament in our country where there's widespread civic ignorance, there's a deep distrust of institutions and one another, and toxic levels of political polarization. States across the country are embracing civic learning as a means of strengthening and sustaining our constitutional democracy. Just since 2021, 33 states have adopted at least 51 policies to strengthen civic education. And just this spring, we're following 218 bills in 40 states, including Senate Bill 23, that seek to strengthen civic education. And back to America at 250, a young person who's in kindergarten right now will graduate from kindergarten this spring/summer. And of course, we'll celebrate our 250th anniversary. We'll have fireworks displays. We'll have tall ships. And that same kindergartner will graduate high school in the year 2038, which is hard to imagine. But 2038 is actually the 250th anniversary of the ratification of the U.S. Constitution. And my question to you all is, what investment will we have made in this rising generation of citizens And I think SB 23 has so many merits and represents that investment in this next generation of Alaskan. So I urge you to vote yes and strongly support the bill. Thank you for the opportunity.
And thank you, Dr. Healy, for your testimony. Does anyone have questions for the testifier? I see that we have a question from Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Story. Dr. Healy, thank you for your testimony. One of the things that really stood out is you said something about distrust in institutions and political polarization, and you also used the term civic ignorance. Do you feel that civic education will help reduce the polarization we see and the distrust of institutions that we see?
I do. So I'd say two things.
Dr. Healy, please introduce yourself for the record again. I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Sean Healy from iCivics. One, we just know, and I know, I'm sure you as legislators experience this on a regular basis, where citizens don't frankly understand where to go to address problems that they're facing in their communities. I see this as I talk to legislatures across the country, as I talk to members of Congress on Capitol Hill. People don't fundamentally understand federalism and how our various layers of government address issues in our communities. So I do believe that when we learn more about these institutions and how they function and really the slow process by which we make change in this country, that we develop a much greater appreciation for those institutions. And then secondly, the question about polarization, this is a proven thing that when in a classroom, we have kind of three key ingredients. And I'll start by saying, as Americans, for the most part, we don't talk about political issues, right? We were taught not to talk about politics and religion in polite company, right? And then the extent to which we do, it's with people who agree with us. And when we do that, those tend to amplify our views, whether we're on the left or the right. We become more progressive or we become more conservative. What we know actually is when we have conversations across difference, but that's actually a moderating force, that brings us close together, at least creates an opportunity for us to compromise and develop consensus. And classrooms are great venues for that. Of course, the conversation in there has to be nonpartisan. And in my experience, teachers do broadly do their very best to facilitate nonpartisan conversations. Young people are still developing a sense of their views on the issues of the day. Classrooms are also politically heterogeneous. We know that from research. And ideally, you have an educator in the room who's trained at facilitating these conversations about the issues of the day across difference. So we develop those civic muscles to have these difficult conversations, which are endemic to our republic, right? They're the issues that our founders grappled with. And frankly, we have a citizenry that doesn't have those muscles. And I would posit that classrooms are the ideal venues to develop them.
Thank you for those comments, Dr. Healy. I like that civic muscle analogy that you put on there. I have two other questions. I have one from Rep. Hemshoot and then from Rep. Dibert.
And mine is really just a comment through the chair. I wanted to just let you know that we are exercising civics here this morning, or civil discourse, because Representative Eichheit did not make a comment on your Wisconsin picture on the wall. And I was very concerned about how that might go. But okay, that's all I had.
Thank you. And then another question for Dr. Healy, Rep. Dibert.
Thank you, through the co-chair. That was a good one. Thank you for being here. I'm excited to look at your website and learn more about it. Third grade teacher for 22 and a half years. I love teaching civics, and I love the importance of voting. And I was, quick question, what would you say to someone who says, my vote doesn't matter? Just a quick thought on that.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Sean Healy from iCivics. One, we have all kinds of examples where your vote does matter. And I'm sitting here, as you acknowledge, I'm a native Wisconsinite and sitting here in the Chicago area. We just had a primary here last night, but I've watched Alaska elections from afar, and your ranked choice voting system, right, which I'm sure there's mixed views of that system on your committee, but it seems like individual votes matter in that system, and it's produced different results in your state. And then I would also broaden the conversation. Voting is just one way in which we participate in our country. In fact, only in presidential elections do a majority of us vote, right? So we're in a midterm election year, and unfortunately, maybe about half of us will vote this coming November. But there's all kinds of other ways in which we get involved in our communities, from volunteering or exchanging favors with neighbors, working with them to solve problems in our community. The individual that preceded me called in to testify, exercised his right to petition the government, right? So many different ways that we can engage in our democracy. Voting is one of them. It's a critical way that we inform who represents us, right? But there are so many other ways to participate. But elections matter. They have consequences. You all know that better than I do.
Thank you for your comments and testimony to the board today, Dr. Healy. We noticed public testimony today, so I'm going to open public testimony. Public testimony is now open. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? I see that we do have someone. Please come to the dais and put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Story, Co-Chair Story, I'm sorry, and committee. Thank you, as always, for taking public testimony. My name is Caroline Storm. Today I'm testifying as myself, a citizen of Alaska for 24 years and only a citizen of the United States for almost 11 years now. I also teach civics for citizenship at the Alaska Literacy Program in Anchorage, and it is such a privilege to teach students who are trying to prepare for their civics test, or their citizenship test. And I apologize, I was not actually going to testify, or I had not prepared testimony, so please bear with me. I was not a super voter until I became a citizen in the United States. And so what I would like to say is it is constantly astonishing to me how few people participate in our process of democracy. And so I want to support this bill in the hope that it would encourage our younger citizens to participate more actively in the reason that you are all here. And so I thank you for your service. It's very important. Your leadership is important. And this bill, I hope, would promote our future leaders to step up and be more active in their country. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room who wishes to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to go online. Do we have anyone online who wishes to testify? No, we do not, so I will close public testimony. Senator Stevens and Mr. Lampkin, if you could come back to the dais, please. I am just noting the time. I'm planning on holding the bill, and at the next bill hearing, we can go over the sectional analysis, and hopefully we can have someone from DEED here to talk about the fiscal note, and I would like to understand that better. We have a few minutes. I did want to open it up to if anyone had a specific question right now, something that they would like them to bring back at their next presentation to us, or any comments. I see a few of them. So, Rep. Schwanke, you haven't spoken lately, and then I'll go to Rep. Dybert.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you, Senator, for being here and bringing forth this bill again, because it is critically important. My only question pertains to some very simple language in the very first paragraph of the bill, and I'm a little bit concerned about the prescription of a curriculum that the board is supposed to develop. And then in the same paragraph, it says a school district may use the curriculum developed by the board. So was there any past discussion about that conflict?
Thank you, Representative Senator Stevens again. Let me just say first, this was a really fun discussion. I mean, I really, you know, we can have fun in this building sometimes. I mean, really important issues, and I appreciate your question. I'll actually turn it over to Tim to get into some specifics. But the intention, of course, is to make it easy for districts to have a curriculum. It's available out there. iCivics has one. We don't have to, you know, reinvent things here. We can just take advantage of what's already prepared. And so if you wouldn't mind, I'll ask Tim to go into the details there.
For the record, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens, through the chair, Representative Schwanke. A couple of things. First, I want to make clear that what the version you have before you continues to be a work in progress. This bill is crafted presently to direct the department to, and the board, rather, through the department to develop curriculum assessment and so forth. It's been made abundantly or increasingly clear that our department, and I won't speak for them beyond the fact that I don't believe in the business of developing curriculum. And there are amendments / work drafts, markups underway that would instead ask or direct the board to provide a list of resources available to districts that they may then use. As regards the may versus shall for a district, that is squarely in the corner of local control. I think that so far we've been trying to build consensus that districts and department and localities have the option to use these resources, and they're not being dictated by a government agency.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. Rep. Dybert.
Thank you, through the co-chair. Along those same lines, Senator, thank you for bringing this bill forward. Like I mentioned before, I taught civics with third graders and love teaching it every year. And I know the importance of it. When I was teaching, I used the kids voting program, which used to be funded by the state. I'm not sure if it's funded anymore, but if we could somehow get that into this bill, it was a great program. Districts could have someone organize it in their communities. And I love my students had won the I Voted stickers. We did the poster contests. And one cool thing out of the kids voting program is that our community had First Friday events to vote on the entries. So you're including parents, you're including the community. And students learn about the candidates starting from kindergarten. And I love the part where the kids voted. We set up booths in our school, and you learn about the privacy of your own vote. And then I always set up an I Voted selfie station just to celebrate their voting. And they got little flags, and we took selfies, and it just so that they're proud. They learned how proud their vote is. But that's a question. Kind of long-winded. Sorry.
Thank you, Representative Dybert. Senator Stevens here again. I don't know much about that program, but we can check with the department, see if they still support it. But I like the idea of not only is it the child in school that's learning about being a citizen, but maybe also their parents. Tim, are you familiar with that program?
Thank you for that. I have Rep. Hemshoot, then I have Rep. Elam.
Thank you, through the chair. It's mostly just comments I want to make. We looked at the recently adopted state social studies standards, and much of this fits within those. So this should not be a heavy lift for schools, but more of a focusing opportunity for schools. I also use the Kids Vote curriculum. It is excellent. I did it in fifth grade. And then if I could just have the indulgence, I know we're in a hurry, but while I was listening, I looked up my aunt taught for 48 years. And when she passed, my cousin found her second grade report cards from 1936. And on the report card, there was reading, writing, math, spelling, music, drawing, phonics, PE, and civics or citizenship as a graded subject in school back in 1936. I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Rep. Himshut. Rep. Elam.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Stevens. I appreciate the bill. Much like everybody else, I just have to kind of make a couple little statements. I'm not a professional educator or teacher, and so I haven't necessarily spent the time you guys have in the classroom. But I do lead a variety of youth events, mostly in ministry stuff. And so I do a backpacking trip every year, and I've got 30 or so teens held hostage on a backpacking trip where their phones and stuff don't work. And so you have some really good conversations. It's incredible what people want to know about civics and what they're not getting in their classrooms and in schools and just kind of in their community. So I do think there's a big need. I really appreciate that. I would be remiss not to ask the question. I noticed it looks like you've got a significant fiscal note that I was surprised to see. Is there something that I'm missing there? It didn't seem like this was going to be that expensive, but it does seem to have a variety of stuff. It looks like it really kind of prioritizes the civics, and so could you speak to that for just a moment, please?
Thank you, Representative Senator Stevens. We were surprised too that it came back with such a high fiscal note, and we're working on that with the department, with the commissioner, and she's very supportive of it, the Commissioner of Education, and hopefully we can bring that down to something reasonable. And you know, maybe it's important to say too at this point that some of our schools are doing a tremendous job. I mean, some of our teachers are doing a great job in civics education, but not all of our schools are, not all of our teachers are. So this is an attempt to make sure it's a statewide program. Tim, any comments on that funding issue?
Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens, through the chair, Representative Elam. I'm not in a position to speak on behalf of the department on their fiscal note. I will mention, however, that as I read the fiscal note, I think that's before you. It was written according to version I, the immediate previous version to the bill. We have tried to adjust that, particularly the opening section, to make the curriculum sources open source, freely available online, is the spirit that we're headed toward, and also in working with the department since then to continue to explore the idea of instead providing a list on their website of these resources, so that should, I think, substantially reduce that fiscal note. But on that point, I defer to the department.
And I have one more question through Rep. Eichheit.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Story. Just a comment on the last question. You know, my financial literacy bill, House Bill 90, that we heard last year, had a fiscal note that, and it had very similar to this bill, was only about 10% of this fiscal note. So I'm a little confused. So I just point you to House Bill 90 and look at that fiscal note. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. I, too, was hoping in your sponsor statement, and when you come back for our next hearing, we talk about the state adopting the new social studies and civics content standards, and in the bill it outlines in the section what should be in the curriculum. It'd be nice to have a copy of the curriculum and see where that is mentioned, and because then it tells us that at least our high schools should be implementing that curriculum already. And I want to note that I think it's important the next time we get together we do the sectional analysis, and also we hear from Deed on hopefully this new fiscal note that will help our decision making. And so I just want to thank both of you for being here today. It's good. And thank you, Senator Stevens, for your longtime commitment to education and civics education. Really appreciate it. So I will hold Senate Bill 23 over. So we are now to the point where we're wrapping up our House Education Committee. We are going to be hearing on Friday House Bill 231 from Rep. Freer, and that is an act relating to education, relating to education reports, duties of the department, relating to teacher retirement systems, relating to the public employee retirement system, and providing for an effective date. Also on Friday, we will be taking up House Bill 261. We will be looking to adopt a committee substitute and going over the changes to 261, which is the three-year averaging of our education funding on the student count. So this concludes our committee hearing. The time is now 9:58, and thank you very much. The House committee is adjourned.